You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger was hailed as a hero last January after he safely landed a disabled U.S. Airways jet onto the Hudson River and, as a result, saved the lives of all 155 people on board. Since then, he has been toasted at the Super Bowl, the Academy Awards, and at a presidential inaugural ball. But as he explains in Highest Duty, a book he has written with Jeffrey Zaslow, his path to glory has not been all that easy because of troubles in the airline industry during the past decade. His salary, for example, has been cut by 40%, and he lost two-thirds of his pension. The book is published by William Morrow. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Well, hi.
The New York Times had a front-page story yesterday about Brian Lawyer, a pilot with ExpressJet Airlines, whose salary recently had been cut in half, and he was demoted from full captain to first officer in a round of cost-cutting. Is this cost-cutting the result of the current economic downturn?
I think it's a result of the final playing out of the Airline Deregulation Act of 1978, exacerbated by the current economic downturn.
It was hailed at the time.
You know, it's done amazing things. It certainly has made air travel more common. More people can fly. It used to be that it was an exclusive thing to be able to do. It was quite expensive. And flying now in constant dollars is very cheap. It's a great value. I think the downside of that is that it's very competitive. The barriers for entry for new carriers are fairly low. And it's difficult for airlines to price their product in order to be able to sufficiently cover their costs.
Didn't the airlines take a big hit after 9/11? People stopped flying.
They certainly did. And SARS and the wars, all these things have taken a toll. But the biggest thing recently, of course, is this economic downturn.
So how is morale among the pilots and flight attendants?
Well, you know, it depends on the company and on the situation. But we've all been greatly affected by it. Many of the things that many people are going through now in the general economy, airline employees have been facing for 8 or more years, certainly since the 2001 terror attacks.
The airlines often blame the unions for their problems, but the unions have been willing to make concessions all along, haven't they?
That's certainly the case at my company and at many others. We haven't said no to the company's demands for concessions and give backs yet.
Now, you said my company. Is there much job mobility in the airline industry, or do people tend to work for the same airline for most of their careers?
That's a very good question. It's something that's not well understood generally throughout the population, is that we're pretty much married to our companies, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, until you either retire or you get your last check.
And why is that? Why can't you just say, American Airlines has offered me a little more money, and I'm going to move unless you match my salary?
Because there's no lateral mobility in a system where your seniority is based on your longevity with that particular company. And going back to the history of the airlines at their genesis back in the 1930s, there are good reasons that we have seniority systems. It prevented the rampant favoritism and cronyism that was going on in the early days. If someone didn't play the game and go along, they wouldn't be promoted, they might be fired. In fact, pilots were fired in the early days for attempting even to organize a union. So the seniority system helped in many of the ways for safety. What it has not provided is a way of lateral mobility, because we don't have a national pilot seniority list, nor do we have a national pilot contract.
You've said that you've noticed a growing public perception that pilots are not necessary any longer, that planes have become so technologically advanced that they almost fly by themselves. How do you think that idea has become so widely accepted?
I think it's just that it's something that a lot of people haven't had a chance to learn about. And one of the things I was hoping to accomplish in this book is to talk about what really is required, what really is at stake, and that I think sometimes we've often made it look almost as if it were so easy that anyone could do it, and that's simply not the case. It takes a lot of training, dedication, and skill and care to make flying as safe as it is.
Despite what we see in some movies where somebody who's never flown a plane is talked into landing a huge commercial jetliner at an airport. That's not so easy. But how has computerization changed the role of pilots on the large commercial airliners?
Well, actually, I would tend to take that question and turn it around. In fact, there's a famous quote from a highly respected researcher, the recently retired professor at the University of Miami in Florida. And he His name is Earl Wiener, and he was famous for saying at a conference where the topic was just that, what's the role of the pilot in the automated cockpit? He said that the topic of this conference instead should be, what is the role of automation in the piloted cockpit?
Well, you have to learn how to run this new equipment, obviously.
Right, and automation doesn't remove the possibility of error. What it does is it changes the nature of errors that are made. And so the automation must be well understood and managed well.
And in our business, which is highly computerized, there are crashes every so often. And then we have to rely on our experience. And you've said that your success in managing the crisis over the Hudson River is due to your many years of flying experience.
Well, this job requires well-learned fundamental skills. It requires in-depth knowledge. And it also requires, to do it well, the kind of judgment that comes only with experience.
So should the flying public be concerned that flying has become less safe because airlines aren't able or willing to pay the most experienced pilots to fly their planes?
My message is that going forward, if we as a society do not choose to value this profession sufficiently, then we may not be able to attract the best and brightest like we have in the past. That we cannot rely on the investments made by previous generations. We have to keep on renewing that investment going forward to increase aviation safety. And those investments need to be made not only in technology, not only in the systems that we use, but in the people that we hire.
I've always assumed that flying was safe because I didn't think the pilot or any of the people involved in getting that plane off the air wanted to die.
Well, of course they don't. But they also need to be working in an environment where it's easy to do the right thing. We need to look at the incentives and the disincentives that exist in every organization and have a culture that supports safety and makes it as easy as possible to do the right thing every time.
You testified before Congress after the accident about your concerns over how pay cuts were affecting the safety of air travel. Some of your testimony was featured in Michael Moore's latest movie, Capitalism, A Love Story. You're a Republican. Did you like that movie?
You know, there is a place in our society for all kinds of advocates. I'm one. I don't want to overstate my case. I want to stick strictly to the facts. I want to speak directly from my experience, and I want to speak from the heart. I'm sure that there is a place in our society for people like Michael Moore, and I think it's interesting that it was in his film that my testimony before the Congress was featured.
I heard that the audience gasped at a recent showing of the movie in Brooklyn when a young female pilot told Mr. Moore that she had to work as a waitress in a diner to make ends meet.
Well, that's what you see at the lower end of the scale. And to those in the industry who claim that they are paying market rates because they're still filling pilot seats and they're still attracting people to apply for those jobs, I would say that there will always be people who are willing to do this job. But depending upon the rates, it may not be the same people doing it today.
Didn't you start a consulting company and try your hand at investing in real estate to supplement your income?
Yes, I've tried several different things. And my first officer on January 15th, Jeff Skiles, has a second business building homes.
Mm-hmm. You give him a lot of credit for what happened, and we'll get into that in a little bit. My guest is Chesley Sully Sullenberger, who's written with the help of Jeffrey Zaslow, Higher Duty, My Search for What Really Matters, and the book is published by William Morrow. I get the impression that you are especially saddened by a general loss of public respect for pilots. You've said that you wouldn't encourage your own daughters to become pilots.
That's true, and I think that's true of many of my acquaintances, my colleagues at work, the very few of them who would recommend that for their children, given the current trends.
Do you think that changed a bit when you brought Flight 1549 safely onto, I mean, you saved all those lives and were immediately declared as a national hero?
Well, it was a wonderful outcome for which we are all very grateful. However, that's not the end. That's only the very beginning. I think in any country, in any democracy, there are two essential elements to solve any significant problem. One is public awareness, and the second is political will. And we're just on the first phase at this point. We're making people aware of what's at stake, what really matters, and what it's going to take to get this industry to the level it needs to be.
And what would you like to see the politicians do?
Well, there are several things they could do. They could certainly encourage the FAA to follow the recommendations of the National Transportation Safety Board and to follow through on recommendations that have been sitting on the books literally for decades. One is on fatigue and updating our rest rules that are generations old. They were written in a different time, in a different world, where the demands weren't as steep in terms of the work hours and the number of flights per day and the conditions under which we work.
Well, didn't you learn to fly jets while you were a student at the Air Force Academy? I would assume that you had to deal with fatigue and stress there as well.
I mean, actually, it's interesting. In peacetime, at least, the military actually has stricter rest rules than civilian airlines do.
Mm-hmm. And the civilian airlines generally rely on the military as a source for their pilots, or they have in the past. Is that still true?
Well, it's not as true as it once was. Historically, until about 15 years ago, the majority of the pilots at the airlines had military experience, and that's no longer the case. It's less than half now.
How much of a role did your military training and background play in your ability to handle the crisis, do you think?
I think it was important. I think many aspects of my background, in some small part, played a role in my ability to handle not only that event, but the aftermath.
Well, you've also talked about the emotional aspect of the aftermath. Everybody was hailing you as a hero, and you were dealing with the equivalent of PTSD.
We literally were, all of us on the crew. And those symptoms lasted for several months. The inability to sleep more than a few hours, the distracted thoughts, you know, the constantly replaying it in your mind, the inability to shut your brain off, the what-ifing and second-guessing, that's just a normal human reaction to this sort of event.
But there must have been some weird kind of disconnect, because on the one hand, everybody, you're getting all these emails, and there's a Facebook fan club, and everybody is lauding you, and you're on every news program on every magazine cover, and at the same time, you can't sleep.
And we also didn't feel like celebrating. It had been a traumatic experience for us. And though we had a wonderful outcome, we were too spent and used up, and we didn't feel like celebrating. We had to process this first before we could feel that in the mood for celebration.
Maybe we should take a little break, and when we come back, we'll actually talk about the flight and what happened, and I'm especially interested in something that we've talked about a lot. What happens when a plane goes up and there are a lot of birds in the area? My guest is Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger. His book, Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters, written with the help of Jeffrey Zaslow and published by William Morrow. Stay with us. We're back with Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, who's written with the help of Jeffrey Zaslow, Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. It's published by William Morrow. Let's talk about the flight, which lost engine power after it struck a flock of Canadian geese. How long had you been in the air when you spotted the Canadian geese in front of you?
Between about 95 and 100 seconds. The flight was completely normal. We had just taken off, retracted the landing gear and the flaps, and I just completed the after takeoff checklist.
But that's a minute and a half to 2 minutes.
Yeah, it wasn't very long. And I looked up, saw the geese just over a football field distance away, about 1 second before they hit us, and with not enough time to react, obviously. And I exclaimed, "Birds," to Jeff.
Had you experienced similar problems with birds in the past?
Nothing like this. I mean, this was unprecedented in my experience. Most commercial pilots have had bird strikes before where you have hit a small bird. It might not even do any damage. When you get where you're going, you have maintenance check it, and you sign off the logbook, and you're on your way. But this was something completely different.
And there's no way to avoid hitting them?
Not with current technology. There are some efforts to control resident bird populations near airports, land use planning in terms of where garbage dumps and wetlands are sited and near airports is one planning mitigation way. But as far as migratory birds like we struck that were at about 3,000 feet, about 5 or 6 or 7 miles from the airport, even these new military radars that they're testing probably would not have detected birds at that distance.
How much do these birds weigh?
These birds, I'm told, had about a 6-foot wingspan and varied in average weights from about 8 to about 16 pounds.
Now, you've compared the sound made by hitting the flock of geese to a heavy rainstorm. The birds that you hit in the past probably didn't cause any damage of this sort.
No, nothing like this. We just flew into a large flock of large birds. It filled the entire windscreen, hit the entire airplane from left to right across the surfaces of the wings, the nose below the level of the windshields, and at least 2 birds in the right engine and either 1 or 2 in the left engine.
And you said you could actually smell the burning birds inside the plane, and you could hear the engines chewing themselves up.
Oh, yes. I mean, you can imagine finely balanced machinery turning at, you know, tens of thousands of revolutions per minute being disrupted by a large, massive object like that.
So you're up in the air for about a minute and a half, and then you hit these birds. How long before the engines quit altogether?
A matter of seconds. They struggled mightily with the abuse to which they'd just been subjected by ingesting the birds, and then they ultimately rolled back to virtually no usable thrust.
Often, if there is a problem, it's the loss of one engine. How often do planes lose the power in 2 engines?
Not very often, and as I say in the book, most of the time it's either due to a fuel leak or fuel problem or to flying through a volcanic ash cloud.
Had you ever had anything like that before, lost power in even one engine?
No. I'd had a career that can be typical these days. You know, the mechanical reliability of the airplanes is such that a pilot can go through an entire career without experiencing an actual engine loss, and that had been my case up until this point.
But you learned later that one of your passengers, Eric Stevenson, had been on a flight 22 years earlier during which the pilot had mistakenly turned off both engines.
Yeah, that was a rare occurrence, and as a result of that incident, the manufacturer relocated some of the engine, the electronic control switches, so that wouldn't happen again.
So you're working very fast. Right now, you're 2 minutes into this flight, and already you've lost power in both engines.
Yes.
If your first officer, Jeff Skiles, had been a little less experienced, do you think you would have problems?
Well, it certainly helped that he was so experienced. Like I, he has 20,000 hours of flying experience. He's been at the airline about 23 years. He's been a captain before the recent cutbacks and reduction in staffing. So he was a great colleague to have both during the event that day and since then.
And you've had nothing but praise for him, for the rest of the crew, the air traffic controller, and you've even had a reunion flight recently, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, just 2 weeks ago I flew with Jeff again for the first time, and the air traffic controller at New York Departure, Patrick Harton, came in to work early that day just so he could work our departure from New York.
Now, have you ever wondered what would happen if any of those people had just miscalculated?
Well, I think we might not have had the same outcome. I think we probably would have had a good outcome, but I think each of them in their own way contributed to the outcome.
Well, after you lost engine power, the air traffic control wanted you to head back to LaGuardia. Did you think that you might be able to make it back to the airport?
Well, it wasn't that he wanted me to. I asked him, I advised him that I was going to consider an attempt to return, and it was his job to find a way for me to do that that wouldn't conflict with other traffic he was working. And he offered me whatever he thought I could use.
How long before you realized that landing on the Hudson River was your best option?
It was in a matter of a minute or so. I quickly considered, and then in evaluating the situation, analyzing where we were, the fact that we were still pointed away from the airport, descended rapidly.
And flying too slow
and at too low an altitude, I thought it was really problematic. It was questionable whether I could get back to LaGuardia. Then I began to consider Teterboro, and after another 20 or 30 seconds, realized that that was simply unattainable, and the only viable option was the river.
Now, we're talking about making all of these decisions in split second. Yeah. Do you remember actually running through all of those alternatives?
Absolutely, clearly.
How high had the plane gotten before the engines quit?
We hit the birds at just below 3,000 feet, and we coasted upward until we were just over 3,000 feet before we lowered the nose and regained a normal flying speed and began descending rapidly to maintain that speed.
There was speculation in the media after the crash that your early training as a glider pilot helped you safely land Flight 1549. Do you think that's true?
You know, again, I think everything I'd done in my life, everybody I'd met, and one of those things I talk about in the book is that part of who made me who I am is that I had all these experiences to draw upon at a moment's notice. But quite frankly, I think my more recent experience flying large jet transports was probably of more help than the gliders I flew 35 years ago.
I was once in a car that hit an ice patch and actually went into a 360-degree turn. And I actually experienced time slowing down, just as it does in the movies. It goes slow-mo. Weren't you surprised when you and Jeff Skiles listened to the cockpit tapes of the flight later and realized just how fast everything had happened?
Absolutely. In fact, I think that's one of the, for me still, to reread what we wrote, that's one of the more moving passages in the book. Later on, when we finally had a chance to together listen to the cockpit voice recording at the NTSB headquarters in Washington, and I didn't think time had slowed down for me. I thought my time perception was normal. It certainly didn't feel the time that time had slowed down at all. It seemed like it happened quickly.
But it turns out that was the case for you.
But it turns out that it happened even amazingly more quickly than I remembered it. It was shocking how fast it happened. It took my breath away to listen to it.
Are pilots trained to think about the passengers only, or are they also supposed to think about their aircraft? After all, this plane was worth something like $60 million.
Well, we were able that day, and I think many would have been able, to clearly set priorities. And the priority had to be to save people at the expense of damaging the airframe.
So the plane could go. There was you were going to save people, but of course, when you landed, you realized that you still had a lot of problems ahead of you.
Absolutely. When we landed in the river, we'd solved the biggest problem of the day, but we hadn't solved all the problems.
If it were a ship, the captain would be saying, "Okay, get the women and the children off first."
Well, I literally said that at one point after we had all evacuated the airplane and I was in the left front raft and the first rescue vessel had approached our raft. I shouted a command to everyone in the raft that the injured and women and children should be rescued first.
Were there injured people?
I'm not sure. There certainly was hypothermia. I don't know if there were other injuries. At that point, it wasn't clear to me. But as it turned out, we were packed so tightly into the raft and the movement within it was so difficult that what happened in effect was that the people nearest the ferry were the ones taken off first.
Well, it was January, so the river had to be very cold.
Yeah, the air temperature was in the low 20s, the water temperature in the mid-30s.
What was the weather like that day?
It had cleared up. Earlier in the day, there had been some snow, but it was partly cloudy, light winds out of the north, and good visibility that day.
My guest is Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger. He has written a book called Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. It's published by William Morrow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How prepared were most of the passengers for the emergency evacuation? You know, when you're a passenger on a typical flight and the flight attendants go through all of that stuff, most people read the newspaper or do something else.
You know, the NTSB had in their investigation, and I knew this from my own personal experience because I had participated as an Airline Pilots Association accident investigator in previous accidents in the earlier decades. They interview all the passengers they can, and they find out a lot about survival factors. Which exit did you use? What announcements did you hear? Did you see the emergency exit lights come on? Did you read the briefing card? A variety of questions. And only 12 people out of 150 in the passenger cabin reported that they'd read the safety briefing card in the seat pocket in front of them. But fortunately, in spite of that, this was a group of well-seasoned, mostly business travelers who behaved very well, I think in large part because of the calm, professional demeanor exhibited by our flight attendant crew. And then they responded in kind, and everybody behaved very well. And the evacuation was orderly.
Well, if you've flown enough times, even if you're not paying attention to that speech, you've heard it so
yes.
many times, and you know to put that little mask on yourself first before you put it on your
exactly.
kid.
Exactly.
And you tried to count the surviving passengers while you were still in the river. Were you afraid you'd lost some?
I wanted to make sure I had not. I was certain that everyone had left the airplane. What I was not sure of was that everyone was going to be accounted for and hadn't fallen into the river. I was in the left front raft, so I could see the people on the left wing and in my raft. The people I could not see, of course, were separated from me, from my sight, by the airplane, by the fuselage. So I attempted early on to get a head count in my raft, and shouting to a man near the leading edge of the inboard part of the wing on the left side, I asked him to get a head count. But those efforts were essentially overcome by events because the rescue happened so quickly.
You've said that the only words that you had time to say to the passengers as you were going down was, "This is your captain, brace for impact." And then you second-guessed yourself. What do you think you should have said?
Well, I decided to make an announcement, and it was about a minute before we landed. And I chose I spent several seconds, which is a lot of time given how time-compressed our experience was. I spent several seconds choosing my words carefully. And I decided to say, "This is the captain, brace for impact." And I used the word brace because that's what we're trained to say. That's a signal to the flight attendants that triggers them shouting their commands, which in this case was brace, brace, heads down, stay down, which they repeated in unison throughout the rest of the landing. And I chose the word impact because I was not yet sure how successful I would be in trading forward speed, airspeed, for a reduced rate of descent in cushioning our landing in the river. So I wanted them to be bracing so they would not be likely to be injured on landing. I chose not to mention that we were landing in water because I didn't have time to give them a full explanation. And the situation I wanted to avoid was where passengers might be reaching under their seats for life vests, maybe even attempting to put them on instead of bracing for a landing, and they might have been injured during the touchdown.
Because we are told, in case we land on water, you should get your life vests. How did it come down? Did it feel okay, or was there a big belly whop kind of feeling?
Well, it's interesting. I'll answer your question by telling you what Jeff and I said to each other for just a second after we'd stopped. So we landed and finished moving and had settled in the river and were obviously intact and floating. And we took just a second before we began doing our evacuation duties. We turned to each other and faced each other for the first time since we'd hit the birds and looked at each other and said almost simultaneously in unison, "Well, that wasn't as bad as I thought."
Well, I have been on any number of flights where the plane is brought down really softly and the passengers applaud. I don't know whether they applauded in this case.
I think they were scared out of their minds. I think they were too surprised to applaud, but it certainly felt hard in the back. I think the tail took the brunt of the initial touchdown in the water. It didn't feel as bad in front as we thought it might. We'd never done this before, and so we didn't know quite what to expect. But it obviously was survivable, and it was obvious that the airplane was remaining intact and was floating.
And you had this fantastic outcome. Everyone on the flight survived. No one was badly injured. And yet, as you said earlier, you suffered post-traumatic stress as a result. Have you spoken to any of the passengers? Did they also experience PTSD?
I've spoken with many of the passengers since that day. I haven't met them all yet. But I think many of them had the same symptoms that we did. It's just a natural reaction to this sort of event.
Does it ever go away?
Oh, of course it does. It went away from me within a few months.
But if you were flying again, do you think, because in the military, I'm told that when people hit stressful situations, then suddenly they feel certain recurrences.
Well, I never did. I think we had enough time to process it, and it took several months. It was something I could handle and incorporate into my personality.
And what's happening now? Are you just back to flying normally?
No, I don't have time to fly a full schedule. I've got a flexible schedule. I'm doing some safety work, and I'm busy with a lot of other projects, being a safety advocate, doing public speaking.
Writing books.
Writing the book, which was there were several reasons I wrote the book. One, I had to answer a question for myself. What was it about this event that captured people's imagination around the world, that made them feel the way they did about this event and about the crew and me? And the answer I came up with and that I share with our readers is that this happened at a time when people needed good news, that the world economic situation seemed to be out of control, that people wanted a reason to feel hopeful again. And I think that they really need reassurance that the potential still existed for good to be done in the world, and that each of us has the potential to do that.
I understand that you were recently approached by the Republican Party to run for a congressional seat in the California district where you live. Have you any interest in getting into politics?
Well, I haven't talked to any party officials directly. I'd heard that was offered to me. I'm not sure if it was a specific offer, but I'm a pilot, not a politician.
Although you would be able to advocate for the things that you consider important.
Well, I think I'm able to do that now. I mean, I'm certainly honored to be thought of in that way by some people, but I'm content to be an advocate in this present forum.
Although you won't be an advocate forever, so you're going to go back to flying? I mean, full time?
I don't know. We'll see how much more public speaking I do. One of the encouraging things I learned in researching this book, and one of the examples I use in it, in fact, I'd used previously in teaching airline pilots at the company years ago, is the example of Captain Hal Haines and the crew of United Flight 232 that crash-landed at Sioux City, Iowa, 20 years ago in July. And Captain Haines is still doing safety lectures around the world 20 years later. I would love to be that fortunate.
The jetliners are getting bigger and bigger. Are they safer when they're bigger, or do they present certain problems?
Well, I think as the technology improves, as the materials that they use and the technology that we have available to us in the cockpit improves, certainly the potential for managing risk is better. But having them larger does create their own issues. I don't know that the airplane size necessarily makes an airplane safer or not. What, in terms of statistical analysis, what does tend to make a difference is not the size of the airplane per se, but the distance it flies. Most of the risk in flight is during the takeoff and landing phase. And so just from a statistical point of view, if you have a plane that flies a long distance and has fewer takeoffs and landings per day, you're better off on that airplane. That tends to be a bigger airplane.
On the other hand, we're not filling airplanes the way we used to, and we're making them bigger and bigger.
Well, that's true. There are a lot of airlines that use smaller airplanes for the short domestic flights where people want frequent service.
Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger's book is Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. It is published by William Morrow, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.
It's been great talking with you.
My pleasure.